Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We'll begin the morning's journey in St. Jay. Then we'll open the phones as we prepare to shift to the opposite side of the state. At 10, we head to Charlotte, learning about the Vermont-based world music label Kombucha. And we finish the morning in Shelburne at Farmcraft Vermont. But first, let's visit the capital of the kingdom, St. Johnsbury. Throughout its history, the town has been known as Bessborough and Dunmore. Ethan Allen then wanted to name it St. John for his friend Jean de Crèvecoeur, but the namee suggested St. Johnsbury to differentiate it from St. John, New Brunswick, or so the story goes. The St. Jay story has been adding some chapters lately, and joining us to tell them is Jillian Sawalki. She's the director of Discover St. Johnsbury. Jillian, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Jillian about St. Jay, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jillian, for someone who hasn't had the pleasure of visiting St. Jay yet, I don't know how that's possible, but give them a little introduction to the town.
Sure. So what's so interesting about the story you told in the introduction about St. Johnsbury is that that naming process means that there's only one St. Johnsbury in the entire world. There are no villages, towns, cities, anywhere else in the world that are called St. Johnsbury. And that speaks to a lot of the unique things and unique experiences you can find in St. Jay. So we're a small town, roughly 7,500 people, give or take. We're located in the southernmost part of the Northeast Kingdom at the intersection of Interstate 91 and 93. So we're fairly rural, but in this very small community, you can have all of these unique experiences. So Dog Mountain is here. That's completely unique in the world as far as a cultural attraction. And the Fairbanks family, who created so many of our cultural institutions and their legacy lives on, have created the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum, the Fairbanks Museum, all of these things that are really worth a visit. And we have a bustling downtown and a thriving community.
It's funny, on your website, and as you mentioned, you know, it says there's only one St. Johnsbury. I support a team over in England, a soccer team called Preston North End, and they're saying is the one and only North End. So I have an affinity for St. Jay being unique in that way, and it's pretty great. Now, in its industrial heyday, what would we have found made in St. Johnsbury?
So there, the large industry that created the bulk of St. Johnsbury's wealth was the industrial platform scale, which was patented by the Fairbanks family, and they brought a large part of the other industry that followed. So certainly they played a large part in bringing the railroad to St. Johnsbury and creating a transportation hub here. They actually weighed hemp. That was their first process. That the reason that they invented this type of scale was to more accurately weigh hemp. There's a great story there, actually, in terms of a new industry that's coming to St. Johnsbury.
Yeah.
An entrepreneurial group called Zion Growers are establishing a hemp processing facility in St. Johnsbury within our downtown. So we're very excited to have that full circle hemp processing through line in our history and coming to fruition again today.
Oh, that's fabulous. And was furniture, too, a big industry there for a while?
Yes, I believe so. There's a special chair that was the St. Johnsbury chair. We have a couple of other industries crackers were made in town. I'm not remembering the whole story. You should get Peggy Pearl on from the History and Heritage Center, and she can give you all of that.
All right, we'll do that. Things are starting to blossom in St. Jay, but when did the seeds of change get planted? What were some of the moves that got what's happening now all started?
So St. Johnsbury, like so many other rural downtowns and rural towns in general, started to suffer with the loss of manufacturing jobs, the closure of a couple of our large employers like St. Johnsbury Trucking and a couple of other businesses. And, you know, that's the same story that's been happening throughout rural America. And that meant that a lot of our smaller businesses closed, and we were having a bit of trouble within our downtown keeping that vibrancy going. However, there were a lot of committed folks who saw the potential of St. Johnsbury and knew that the problems that we were having were, again, not unique to this particular town. You know, they're the same conversation that's happening in, you know, rural West Virginia. They saw the potential of our cultural institutions and our artisanal products that are being created in town, and there has been a sustained and intentional development of our community that has brought us to where we are today, where we had 12 new businesses open up within the downtown last year alone. Mm. I think there's a good handful already in the works this year, and that's the most we've ever seen. So our streets are really bustling. We have a shopping scene. We have a foodie scene. A lot of the things that got us there were the Vermont Community Council on Rural Development's Community Visits Program, which happened in 2015. That gathered the whole community together and helped them set some priorities. And from there, the town and private individuals and our planning commission and all of this stuff have been working to identify some of the problems within the town and fix those, and then identify opportunities and chase those as well. So the reopening of the New Avenue House is a great example of that. A lot of the new businesses that opened up last year pointed to that specifically as a big turning point for them, to know that what was a fairly dilapidated building with no businesses in its storefront retail spaces was going to have new ownership, full renovation, and that has absolutely made a huge difference on the town.
You can feel it when you get to St. Jay now that yep. It has turned around. Let's talk about some of the events in town. We'll get to all the businesses. It's going to be fun strolling around downtown St. Jay with you. But I know you hit your apex when it comes to events on June 4th. That was the annual pet parade, which has been going on since like 1949. It's just brilliant. What are some of the other things going on in town this summer and fall?
Yeah, we have a very, very full schedule. I put up a social media post a while back showing our events board, you know, in the Welcome Center. It's completely covered in posters. There's absolutely no room for anything else. So we have a couple of signature things that are happening in St. Johnsbury that people will be familiar with. So there's the pet parade that you mentioned. That was in early June. And, of course, Catamount Arts' Levitt Amp St. Johnsbury Music Series, which has transformed Dog Mountain into this amazing concert venue, is back every Sunday. They're also working with us to bring that Levitt Amp concert to the downtown of St. Johnsbury with our series St. Jay Final Fridays. That takes place on the final Friday evening of June, July, and August. So we've had two of those already and are really looking forward to the one in August as well. We have an all-new series of which we're calling Food Truck Pop-Up at the Pavilion. So we have this beautiful new Trailhead Pavilion, and we wanted to call attention to that and draw people to that area that's going to see a lot of development once the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail is completed. And the terminus for that, of course, is in St. Johnsbury. So we have food trucks there on the second Tuesday of every month. So there's one coming up in just a week's time on August 9th, and that's the last one of the season. Goodness, and I'm sure there are so many more. That's what I'm thinking of for the summer. Dog Mountain, of course, has dog parties.
Yep.
We've had a couple of fundraiser events from our cultural institutions, which are always a really good time. They're St. Johnsbury FNEM hosted something called the Bierstad Festival, which the name of that ties back to a famous painting that they have in their gallery. And
Discovery St. Johnsbury.com. DiscoverSt.Johnsbury.com is where you can find even more. You mentioned
Absolutely.
Catamount Arts. How has having Catamount Arts helped the town add that vibrancy that's there now?
I can't say enough good things about what Catamount Arts has done for St. Johnsbury. Having them located here has been huge. I know myself, I grew up in a town just outside of St. Johnsbury, and the fact that I was able to experience through their programming all of these amazing world-renowned performances and acts just as a school child really shaped my life, and they continue on that path today. So Jody Freed is the executive director there. He's extremely involved and passionate with the Vermont art scene in general and a fierce advocate for what we call the creative economy. And I've fully drunk the Kool-Aid on that one. So, you know, the idea is that creativity and vibrancy showcased within a community creates communities that people want to live in and that thrive financially as well as culturally and socially.
And Jillian, as we found in Vermont's downtowns, having merchants that attract people into town is key. So tell us about the mix of shops that you have in downtown St. Jay.
Absolutely. So we have a number of institutions that have been there for quite a while and do just amazing work that are have been and will be worth a visit all their own. So we have Moose River Lake and Lodge Store, which is a full-service home goods and store with a really fantastic wine shop in the back. They have a full-service jewelry store there as well. Boxcar and Caboose is our independent bookstore. We love having an independent bookstore downtown. That's so important these days. And they have a candy shop, and they have Legos and a really fantastic kids section. That's especially important for folks like myself who have young kids to know that you have a place where you can go and drop off your kids and just have them play for a couple of hours if you want them to. And we've really grown the number of dining establishments that you can find and the diversity of dining establishments that you can find in St. Johnsbury and gift shopping as well. Like I said, we had 12 new businesses open within the downtown last year alone, and most of those are really unique retail shopping options. So we have Haven Home, which is a secondhand mid-century modern home goods store. They actually won best in Vermont from Apartment Therapy of secondhand shops. So we're so thrilled to have them. They've been around for less than a year. Art and Joy is a new gift shop, and that has a really great curatorial mindset, gifts and art and home goods. I hope I'm going to pronounce this correctly. Isbrydoliaeth. It's a Welsh word. It means inspiration, and it's a very cool curiosity shop that opened within the last couple of months as well.
You did well. I think our one listener in Cardiff might have, you know, a bone to pick with you, but I thought you did a beautiful job.
I did practice. There's a lot of vowels.
Well, I don't want to get anyone drunk, but there are some great beers and spirits being created in town, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is where it's helpful that St. Johnsbury is a walkable community, and we have a couple of lodging options within walking distance of the town. We have St. Johnsbury Distillery, which creates rum and gin and vodka right within our downtown. So what's unique about them? They produce all of their product on site, so they're not bringing in distilled spirits from elsewhere and then just mixing the recipe together. They're really doing all of that distilling right on site. And you can visit their distillery. It's right within the downtown, as I said, so you can see the product being made and experience their speakeasy style tap room. They have a really fun, lovely spot to sample some of their products in bespoke cocktails, and they have a beautiful patio, and I can't speak highly enough of that experience. We also, within the downtown, have Whirligig Brewing, which, again, also brews on site. Full disclosure, my husband and I do own that business, but I think that we make some pretty good craft beers.
As a neutral voice, I've been there. I both ate and drank there and had a great time, so it is pretty wonderful.
Yeah, we focus on sour beers, but he has a full lineup. So you can get your IPAs, you can get your lagers, you can get your stouts as well. And there's an on-site food vendor, Taco Poco, so tacos and beer. It's hard to go wrong.
Yep. And one more brewery, right?
That's correct, yes. And St. J. Brewery is located outside of the downtown in the mall, and they have an enormous brew system, so it's really worth checking out to see that their brewery in action, and they've got a really nice tap room there as well with food and delicious things to sample.
And don't worry, there's plenty of great coffee options downtown. But you mentioned the food. It's really crazy interesting, the ethnic cuisines, the mix of ethnic cuisines now available in St. Jay.
Sure. Well, all food is someone's ethnicity.
Yeah, so that's true.
Certainly every community has ethnic food.
Fair, fair point.
Within different cuisines, the variety is pretty unique. We actually have Vermont's only Filipino restaurant. That's Pika Pika Filipino Cuisine. They have such a great setup on Main Street, a great jumping off point for experiencing all of the cultural attractions that you can find, the museum and the Athenaeum up there, in a really elevated setting. It's just a must visit while you're in St. Johnsbury. And we actually do have a number of different Filipino food establishments, or it's become quite a concentration recently, actually. Central Cafe is owned by a Filipino man, and there are farm-to-table, high-end plates that they offer, but also a couple of Filipino dishes. And our farmers market has a new Filipino food vendor there. So we've become a bit of a capital of Filipino cuisine in Vermont and probably within the North New England. I should look that up for sure.
Yeah.
We also have a staple of our Saturday farmers market is Genuine Jamaican, and the emphasis there is on genuine. It is delicious. It is spicy. It's got all the jerk flavoring that you could wish.
Now, housing has been tight throughout the state, but isn't St. Jay also in the middle of reclaiming some buildings, turning them into residences, making progress in that way?
Sure. Rural Edge is a big partner in this whole area of the Northeast Kingdom on establishing affordable housing options. They've purchased a number of properties within St. Johnsbury and are in the process of converting them as we speak. That absolutely is such a big issue in Vermont as a whole right now, so we're so happy to have them as partners to help deal with that crisis.
And there are beautiful neighborhoods within walking distance of downtown, which is another real nice part of St. Jay. Now, other attractions we must discuss. I came for the bug art, stayed for the rest. Author Joe Citro says it's a museum that should be in a museum, the Fairbanks Museum. Tell people a little bit about that if they've never been.
So I like to describe it as a Victorian cabinet of curiosity.
Yeah.
And I know as a child it really inspired me as well. It's just a completely unique experience to walk in there and have what's largely been preserved from its original state back in Victorian times. So you've got some fantastic taxidermy and unique bug art, right?
Yes.
I'm glad you mentioned that. they also have added an enormous number of interactive STEM-themed activities and a fantastic butterfly house that are bringing the museum into the 21st century as well. So you can have that historical experience, but then also really engage with natural history and science in a unique way. It also has Vermont's only public planetarium, so you can go and have a fantastic star show while you're in St. Johnsbury.
The Athenaeum, not just a library, it is one special place to visit.
That's right. So in addition to being our public library, and they do a fantastic job at that, they are a hub for cultural activities, reading-based activities, literacy-based activities. They're the host site for the Vermont Humanities First Wednesdays lectures, which we love having in our town. And they also have a beautifully preserved art gallery, which is largely unchanged since it was first created, featuring an epic painting by Bierstadt of Yosemite. And that alone is worth a visit and is open to the public as well.
And, of course, if you bring your dogs, take them out to Dog Mountain just outside of town. Check out the beautiful artwork of Jonathan Stephen Hunick, and his furniture is beautiful as well. We're almost out of time, but I know you invite people to explore 48 hours in St. Jay. What a great idea. What do you hear from visitors who take you up on that and come into town?
Well, I find folks who visit are really surprised to see the variety of experiences that they can have. And again, I said this before, so I'm repeating myself, but for such a small community, you really can spend a long weekend here and not leave the town. And that is pretty unique. You can, of course, you know, we're a great jumping off point for the Northeast Kingdom. So if you're coming here to bike, if you're coming to go hiking, if you're going to go to Willoughby Notch, absolutely stay in St. Johnsbury, get your food and drink and shopping on here, and then go and do that. But you really can just come and find that really great balance of outdoor recreation and great food and drink and shopping and cultural experiences.
And the rail trail comes into town. Jillian Sawalki is the director of Discover St. Johnsbury, the St. Johnsbury Chamber of Commerce. And again, to learn more about what's happening in town, you can visit discoverstjohnsbury.com. Jillian, I want to thank you so much for the tour around town. It was fun.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll return for a half hour of open phones. And it's game two of the Sox-Astros series in Houston tonight. Our coverage begins at 7:10. First pitch is at 8:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Let's squeeze a half hour of open phones in here until 10. Danny, you remember where we hide the open phones button. There it is. Okay. We had John and Ryan Kerrigan on yesterday talking about running and sky running. Sky running is where you do a 1 kilometer climb and then run on mountains of at least 6,500 feet in altitude. Ouch. So what are some of your greatest athletic feats? And that's F-E-A-T-S. I'll share my running exploits and my best performance ever. Yes, it was Boston. Just you wait. Trade deadline for the Sox today at 6. Sellers, buyers, looks like sellers. Rob Manfred, the commissioner, can move that trade deadline from between July 28th through August 3rd. So it's on the later side this year. Is that making a difference? And with extra playoff teams, any difference there? Should it be moved even later? Yeah, and then the other day I mentioned my Uncle Dick when he was calling bad drivers dumb bunnies. Is there a G or PG rated term you use when you have a car full of kids when I cut you off on I-89 or I'm driving too slowly on Route 14? One of my old bosses used to call people hoo-has. That was his name. Love to hear some that I can use in place of the names I now use. The phones are open, and Danny is just back from vacay, so he's really anxious for you to answer your calls at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And we begin in the number one position with Fred, the Duke of Newbury, the Duke without portfolio. Good morning, Your Grace.
There you go. You got it.
How long? It's taken me a year and a half.
Right. So, anyways, my thing today is education in the United States. Mm. Education in the United States has failed. And, you know, what can you do? It's just failed. And the reason why I say it's failed is because the Army can't maintain its quotas that it needs every month. And the reason why the Army can't maintain its quotas every month are two big ones. And one is physical. People are overweight. That's one of the reasons. But the one that's shocking is the people that are willing to join the Army can't pass the written test. And that's an indication that education in this country has fallen apart. The pool for the draft is 30 million people. And all the smart kids don't want to join the volunteer army. And so the military has a really problem because they can't get anybody that's qualified to go into the military, especially the Army.
All right. So, Fred, anyway, let's look at this. Now, what do you think has been the failing in the education system, and what would you do to change it?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, if I was an educator, that would be a good thing. But anyways, so here's what's the deal. The deal is the failure is the people that take the test that can't pass the test, their word knowledge is below par. Their paragraph comprehension is below par. And they can't do basic arithmetic. I mean, the test in arithmetic is a test in arithmetic. It's adding, subtracting, and divide. They don't ask you to do algebra. They don't ask you to do quadratic equations. I mean, it's just simple arithmetic, and simple arithmetic seems to be a very, very difficult thing for these people to do, and they can't, their paragraph comprehension is below par, and their word knowledge is below par.
Well, Fred, I don't have any children, so I haven't had, a real good look at what's happening in education since, the 70s. I went to grad school in the 80s. But, I hear a lot of teaching to the test. Have we gotten away from, teaching the basic skills to, teaching towards the test, which is the evaluation of how our schools are doing?
Well, I suspect that teaching to the test is probably failed because in order to do the test, you got to be able to do arithmetic. And if they don't have arithmetic on the test, then you can pass the test because the kids can't do arithmetic.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is, it's obvious. And nobody wants to talk about it. It's obvious. If you go back to the 60s, the kids that were getting drafted, the kids that were joining the Army, they could at least do arithmetic and had basic paragraph comprehension.
Yeah.
But today they can't find these people today.
Fred, so the these are good points. I've tutored both a mother and her daughter over, span of, I'd say, about 12, 15 years difference. And it was very interesting because I had to go back and relearn some things and then learn how it's taught today. And that's, different. I can remember sitting at the kitchen table as a kid when after dinner, we'd all do our homework, four kids, and then my mom usually was there to kind of help and guide. And, this was, mid-60s through early 70s, and Mom used to kind of, under her breath, you know, curse this new math. And I know, you know, what's being taught today tests me on what's being taught. I can still do long division, and when I push myself, I could even do long square roots in my head. I could do multiplication in my head. You know, now I'm good at math, but why am I able to do that? And, you know, we hear a lot of people say they don't like math. I will tell you that the story of the mother and the daughter who I tutored, Mom's skills were poor. They were poor math skills, but she worked really hard. And I would push her, and she rose to the challenge. And she had grades that were so poor to start with, and finished a remedial math class in the high 90s, and then got in the 90s in the next two math classes that she needed to finish when she was going back to school for an associate's degree. Her daughter had the math skills. They were there. It was more a case of not taking the time and just some sloppy work. And in no time, and she was in danger of not being able to play the two sports. I think she played softball and field hockey, and she would have lost the opportunity to play sports. So she had that motivation, and she had the skills. She just needed someone to kind of coach her up on taking her time, cleaning up, you know, on her computations, and in no time again, she was scoring in the 90s. As a matter of fact, as a freshman in her high school, she was invited to take some kind of math aptitude test at UVM. Maybe sometimes too, Fred, it's a matter of, you know, having a little extra guidance, and it's not always easy. We've all sat in classrooms. Teachers have to make decisions, you know, on how to spend their time. And, sometimes it's easier to spend that time with those who are getting it. That is not an indictment on our teachers. As a matter of fact, no one, has more respect for the work teachers do than I do. It's hard to think that, you know, we could pay them more. I'm sure we can, and I'm sure we should, because the work they have to do, it's staggering. But anyway, let's take a break. Good questions, Fred, though. Lot to ponder there. And math skills, maybe when I retire, I'll be a math tutor. I've got to learn the new math, whatever they call it now. But all right.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Phones are wide open, 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. Your chance to discuss your athletic exploits. You can shout out the kindest expletives you use in the car when your kids or grandkids are about. Or if you want to tell me to get a haircut or correct my grammar, now is your chance. Somebody asked this question this morning. Do political endorsements make a difference to voters? That's an interesting question. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I want to remind you, tomorrow morning at 9, we've got Kevin Clayton of Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne, Kevin Ring of Decant Wine Shop in Woodstock. We're going to have an hour of wine show tomorrow morning from 9 to 10. All right. Whoa, here we go. Well, let's head to Corinth. Start with Forbes. Good morning, Forbes.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I've got a little problem. Maybe you could help me out.
Sure.
I have a conventional automobile and truck that runs on gasoline. And when I go down to the station, I'm paying something like 34.34 cents per gallon, both federal and state, road and bridge repair fees. I'd like to know what folks with electric or hybrid are paying towards that roads and bridge repair? And how is that done?
Yeah, excellent question, Forbes. And this is one that the legislature has tussled with, I mean, the idea is to charge a fee to those who have an electric vehicle for that maintenance. That, those maintenance costs are real. We want to drive on repaired roads. We want to make sure that our bridges don't fall apart like they did in Minneapolis several years ago. You know, what happens if we do all shift to electric, right, Forbes?
That's correct.
Where does that money come from? And it's a great question. It's one that is, being discussed, has been for the last several years. I think 4 or 5 years ago, this started to be an issue, at least in the planning stages. I don't know the answers yet. I don't know that electric vehicle owners are really paying that share, but it is something that will need to be addressed probably sooner rather than later. Great question, Forbes. Thanks.
Well, as you can see, I'm kind of being discriminated against.
In effect, yes. The burden will shift more to those with who are using gasoline than those who are using electric in the years ahead. Maureen is next. Hi, Maureen. Go right ahead.
Hi. My husband travels to New Hampshire most every week, down and back in a couple of days. And every time when he walks out the door, I feel compelled to tell him to watch out for those dumb dodo birds out there.
Dumb dodo birds. All right.
Yep.
Okay. I like that. So that answers one of my questions. What do you call those bad drivers? And you're not impugning the folks of New Hampshire per se, but just in general, dumb dodo birds are those
just
bad drivers.
In general, the other folks that are driving on the highway.
I love it. The dumb dodo birds. Thanks. Thanks, Maureen.
You're welcome.
All right, be careful driving. The dumb dodo birds. All right, let's head to Shelburne next. We've got Ted. Hi, Ted. Good morning.
Good morning. I was accepted into the military reserves.
Mm.
I passed the test.
Good.
But what I was thinking about was finding some anthropologists. I remember anthropology majors. Find out, study our society, study our culture. And also, there is such, it seems to me, there's maybe an increasing contrast between the ones who Fred was talking about, who are just, whose education is not equipping them at all. Where the education really comes from, is it schools or is it screens? And motivations, but fine, and I'm not capable of getting academic, but I do remember the anthropology, studying other cultures and foreign cultures. Study this culture and contrast it from, over the decades and see how screwed we are, if we are.
Yeah,
in a way, and where it's coming from, what the basis is, and what we might do to alter it.
Ted, brilliant point. What happened when all of a sudden in the 60s, 70s, all of a sudden most of our time was taken up in front of a television set, and in later years, computers, video games, and now our telephones that we carry in our pockets. I would love to have anthropologists study that, and they probably are. I'd love to hear the results. Let's head to another Fred, this one in New Haven. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Okay, in response to Fred and the service...
Turn your radio down, Fred.
I'll shut it off. Just a minute.
All right, go ahead,
Fred.
Where
did we ever get to in a point in this country where only people of a certain education level can serve this nation? We got all kinds of college kids that are coming out of here that have the nerve to think that they don't have to enlist in the service, okay, and that somebody beneath them has an obligation to do all this and secure their place.
Yep.
Okay.
Gotcha.
That's one thing.
Go ahead.
And as far as this electric vehicle thing, the legislature has bashed this thing all around because they don't want to touch it because it's touchy-feely and we're saving the environment. It should be reflected in their registration.
Yeah.
Anybody can pretty much figure out how many miles a car is going to go a year. You base their registration fee on that.
Fred, I think that's where we're headed. Thanks for that call. And your first point, you know, Fred, the Duke of Newbury has, you know, asked that question a number of times based on what he's talking about, the education levels and getting into the military service. He has asked very directly, do we need to reinstitute the draft? It's boy, that would be a bitter pill to swallow, probably a hard one for politicians to say yes to. But Fred has brought up that question a number of times, and it's a compelling question. And Fred, your point certainly kind of carries that another step forward. Thanks, Fred from New Haven. Charlie from Middlesex, sorry we're out of time. We got to roll. Director Danny, let's fire those retro rockets and land this ship. Open phones are now sealed up for another session. We'll break for CBS News, and then we'll learn about kombucha. No, not kombucha. And coming up today at 1, we've got 3 full hours of The Getaway with His Excellency Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. You're listening to Misolu by Kimi Jabate of West Africa, one of the artists on the Kombucha music label based here in Vermont. Kombucha is also a booking agency and music publisher. It was started in 2006 by Jacob Edgar and is based in Charlotte. Last week, we had the pleasure of meeting Kombucha artist Dobe Nyore of Côte d'Ivoire. Now it's our turn to meet Jacob Edgar. Jacob, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great to be here, Rick. Thank you.
Great to have you. Listeners, to ask Jacob about how he finds musical artists around the globe or about Kombucha, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You're an ethnomusicologist, Jacob. So start off by explaining what that is.
Yes, it's a fancy word.
It is.
But it's basically, it's a combination of ethnography, so the study of humans, essentially, and musicology. If you imagine an anthropologist who specializes in music, that's essentially what an ethnomusicologist is. So we study the ways in which people create and use music, both in the past, in the present, and to some degree in the future, too. What it says about our societies, what it says about our cultures, and what it reveals about us as people.
Where did your interest in these sounds from all over the world come from?
Well, I actually grew up in Vermont. I moved to Plainfield in the late 70s when I was a little kid, and like many people who moved to Vermont in that era, I had progressive parents who were interested in music from around the world. So the record collection that we had at home included Bob Marley and Baba Tunde Olatunji and Taj Mahal and all kinds of, you know, stuff that reflected the popularity of African and folk music from around the world that had, you know, really started in the 50s and 60s. And so I just listened to all of that, and it was, you know, for a kid growing up in rural Vermont, it was very transporting. It took me to places that I wasn't able to go to in person. And of course, I was always very interested in music. I was doing music throughout elementary school and high school. And when I was a senior in high school, I spent a year abroad as a foreign exchange student in Iceland and did lots of music there. And music was just always a great way to connect with people and to learn about the world. And so whenever I traveled, I was always exploring local music. Whenever I met new people from another part of the world, I would ask them about their music, or we would play music together. And so it was just always this interest in music and the way it reflects, you know, different ways of living and different kind of approaches to things. And I always found it fascinating.
Ah, kudos to your parents. What is your connection to Putumayo world music?
I've been the head music researcher for Putumayo since 1998, so it's been a long time now. And my job for Putumayo is to travel around the world and find the songs that end up on their compilations. So basically, they pay me to listen to music, and so it's a great gig. I write all the liner notes for the Putumayo compilations, and oversee general product development. And in the past couple of years, we've been really focused on playlisting. So Spotify and Apple Music and Pandora and all of these streaming and download platforms, Putumayo has been transitioning a lot of what they do in music discovery onto those platforms. So every Friday, I update new playlists with new songs. And so basically, I'm just constantly listening to music.
What a great gig. And then how did Kumbancha come into being?
Kumbancha started back in 2006. And at that time, I was living in New York, or just before that, and working for Putumayo full-time. And I just decided I wanted to start my own project and help individual artists develop their careers. You know, so Putumayo is very focused on compilations. And what we like to say is that the compilations were like dating, and starting an artist-based label was like getting married. You know? So I fell in love with a bunch of artists and decided to get married to some of them and to really throw my hat in the ring and see what we could do together. So I started Kumbancha in 2006, just as my family and I had also decided to move to Vermont. So we moved here to Charlotte. We bought the property that houses Charles Eller, now Lane Gibson, recording studios. Mm-hmm. And so we have this world-class recording studio here on site, and just this beautiful property with a big barn filled with CDs and musical instruments. That's our office. And this is where the world headquarters of Kumbancha is now.
Of great world music. Now, Kumbancha is a great word. Explain what it means and why you've chosen it for your company.
Yeah, sometimes I regret it because it sounds so similar to kombucha, which wasn't a thing really when
right.
I started.
I know.
But, Kumbancha is an Afro-Cuban word. So I've always been really into Cuban music. And if you get together with a bunch of friends and you have a bottle of rum and a guitar and you sing and you dance and you party, and the next thing you know, it's 3 a.m, that's a Kumbancha. So the idea was, you know, it's this notion of a musical gathering, a musical celebration. And so I thought it was a good word, you know, sort of a mysterious word, similar to Putumayo in that sense. Like nobody, it evokes something you don't really know.
Right.
What, but it does have a deeper meaning.
Yeah. Now, before we get too far down the road, we heard, I'm not sure if I'm going to get the name right, but Kimi Djabate, we heard the music at the start. Tell us about that artist.
Oh, fantastic. And that's wonderful because we're just about to release a new album with Kimi. It's coming out this fall, and it's all finished and pressed and everything, and I'm really excited about it. Kimi is a great example of why sending demos in cold to a record label sometimes pays off. So back, I don't know, it must have been over 10 years ago now. Yeah, I used to get lots and lots of CDs in the mail back before digital music was the main delivery platform. So my mailbox was filled with new music, and I would go through it every day. And there was a CD in an envelope with no return address and just the name Kimi written in Sharpie on the disc. And, you know, I listened to pretty much everything, so I put it in, and it was fantastic music. And I had really been toying with this, how do I develop totally unknown artists? And so I had been starting this series called the Kumbancha Discovery Series, which was a way for me to sign kind of unknown artists and give them a leg up. But I didn't know how to reach Kimi. You know, there was no contact information. And I just kept listening to his music over and over again. And then finally, he gave me a call. So that was good. Wow. He tracked me down and he said, oh, did you get my CD? And I finally figured out who it was. And so we made the connection. And I ended up releasing an album with him about 10 years ago now. And we're about to do a second one together that's really fantastic. And I'm super excited about it. He's from Guinea-Bissau, which is one of the former Portuguese colonies in West Africa. So it has sort of a lilting kind of Portuguese influence in the music. But Kimi grew up as a griot in a musical family and plays all types of instruments. And now he's based in Lisbon. And one of the fun things that's happened with Kimi over the last couple of years is the pop star Madonna, who I'm sure you've heard of, moved to Lisbon a number of years ago and got really into the Afro-Portuguese music scene in Lisbon and started collaborating with a bunch of local musicians. And so Kimi and Madonna recorded a song together called Bella Ciao, which is just really funny that these two artists collaborated.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Lisbon.
And now they're good friends, so.
One of the great cities in the world. It's not just a record label. Explain all that Kumbancha is.
Well, you know, like I said, we're a music development company. I mean, obviously records are the delivery platform, and not even anymore, but really the goal is to try to help promote international music and international artists and help people everywhere, not just in the U.S., but around the world, expand their horizons and recognize that this is a diverse world and people do things in all different kinds of ways. So we're trying to break the barriers down between, you know, kind of mainstream pop music and, you know, music that we think people are really going to like if they just get the opportunity to listen to it. And, you know, with Putumayo, we really proved that there was a huge market for what we call world music, for music that's from a variety of different cultures. But it was a really untapped and unreached market and ignored market in many ways. But, you know, great music crosses boundaries. And if you don't have to understand the words to really enjoy something. And I do genuinely believe that listening to music from cultures that aren't your own makes you, you know, helps improve the world. It makes you more understanding and interested in the world around you.
It unites. We're speaking with Jacob Edgar of Kumbancha about how Charlotte became a world music hotspot. If you've got a question or comment for Jacob, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I had a habit of meandering in record stores back in the day, sometimes buying albums because of their covers. And maybe that explains why I bought Fela Kuti's 1981 album, Black President. That led to an album called African Image Roots by Tom Nkazi. Around the same time, American artists were discovering this sound. Mick Fleetwood released The Visitor. Stuart Copeland did The Rhythmatist in 1985, and a year later it was the smash hit Graceland by Paul Simon. All these albums were part of something that was emerging as world music. Of course, those were hybridized. And we're speaking with Jacob Edgar of Kombucha, based in Charlotte, who has spent at least a quarter century finding musicians from the far corners of the globe for you to hear, like we're hearing now, Rupa and the April Fishes.
De l'idéologie de la religion.
That is Un Américain à Paris. And if you'd like, or an American in Paris, if you'd like to ask Jacob about his musical finds, you can join in at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK. Jacob, tell us about that band. Great name, Rupa and the April Fishes.
Yeah, Rupa is a fascinating person. She lives in San Francisco. That's where the band is based. And she is just has an incredible personal history. Her family is originally from India, and they moved to the U.S. and she was raised in the Bay Area, and she became a doctor. So she her day job is as an emergency doctor, emergency room doctor. At least it was at the time that we worked together on this album.
Wow.
And a musician by night, and very, very. You know, interesting blend of sounds. She spent a lot of her childhood also in southern France, so she speaks perfect French and brings those flavors into her sound. So just a really interesting mix of flavors.
Well, you're tracking down these artists from all over the globe. How many different languages do you speak?
I speak Spanish very fluidly, French haltingly, Portuguese well enough to communicate, and thanks to my wife, a little bit of Dutch, and I get by in Icelandic as well.
Nice.
I speak most of the colonial languages, you know, so
right.
That gets you pretty far in the world.
That does, because some of others are kind of offshoots, and you can kind of figure it out. Who are some of the artists that you've put on those Putumayo CDs and playlists that then captured the world's attention?
Oh, I mean, so many. Over the years, I've done hundreds and hundreds of Putumayo collections, and you know, it's always amazing to go back and see who we'd featured back before they were stars. You know, I mean. We've had artists, you know, who are now filling stadiums that were originally featured on Putumayo CDs, and we have artists that, you know, kind of were one hit wonders. So it's a real range. It's a real range, and I think that's what's fascinating about music is you never know where it's going to go, and there's so many factors that make an artist successful. It can be, you know, one song that really works, or it can be years and years of building a solid fan base, and it's just really fascinating to see how musicians navigate in the world.
The Kimi story was really interesting. Can you share another story of finding someone, you know, unheard of, and then you heard their music and you said, "I've got to get this out to the world," and it changed them. You know, they became. Just part of the world music conversation.
Well, I mean, in some cases, it's interesting. Like an artist like Kimi is somebody who's totally unknown, even in Lisbon. You know, like people don't really know him that much. I mean, they're starting to now, but at the time they didn't. But I also have always been really interested in artists that are superstars in a particular place and yet are totally unknown, right? So a couple of the artists that I've worked with, like Kailash Kher, is a household name in India. I mean, he's just huge. He was like one of the judges on the Indian version of American Idol, and he sings in a lot of Bollywood films, and his music is played everywhere. But nobody outside of India had ever heard of him until I started working with his records. And then the big success story for me has been an Israeli artist named Idan Reichel, who had a song that mixed elements of Falasha Ethiopian music into sort of a, this kind of fusion of Israeli and Middle Eastern and African sounds, and had built a really solid following in Israel. And I went to see him in New York at a show that was taking place in a church, and it was a benefit for the Pakistani Earthquake Relief Fund. And the venue was just filled with all of these sort of young, hip Israelis who have gone off and explored the world. And it was just a fascinating scene, and really kind of played with my stereotypes of, you know, politics and just the understanding of the world and Israel in that context. And here was a musician who was working with Arab artists, who was working with, really just a wide range of faiths and beliefs. And it was fascinating. So we ended up working together, and we've now done 6 albums with his project, and then 2 albums as a collaboration with the Malian guitarist Viafar Couture. And since those days, Idan has just become massive everywhere. I mean, pretty much everywhere he plays, he fills out large stadiums, and he's collaborated with big pop stars like Alicia Keys and Dave Matthews and Indy Irie, and wrote a song for the Eurovision Song Contest, and has become an even bigger star now than he was then. And it's just been such a interesting process to work with him, you know, in so many ways, both to work with an artist who's so creative and just a natural genius of an artist, but also a really wonderful human being who has to navigate a lot of complexities of being an Israeli pop star in this world, you know. So it's interesting.
When you're not listening to world music, is there a guilty pleasure? Is there something you have popped into your 8-track player that you really enjoy?
I mean, you know, I'm definitely a child of my time. So my driving collection when I'm, you know, the one that makes my kids groan is, you know, classic rock, Led Zeppelin, Van Morrison, the Beatles, all of the, you know, the stuff from the 70s and 80s. I just love that stuff. And I find myself listening to it all the time.
And, you know, speaking of, I mentioned the 8-track tapes, but speaking of technologies, are you seeing a resurgence in vinyl like the rest of the industry is at Kumbancha?
To some degree, it's a very unique phenomenon in the sense that vinyl appeals to a certain audience. You know, it's a younger audience, and they tend to be looking for certain types of music as well. So I have released quite a few records on vinyl, and have had mixed success with it, mostly because I just think, you know, I'm not necessarily doing the type of music that is really what people are looking for necessarily on vinyl. Yeah. That said, and I also, you know, it's funny, I'm not an audiophile in the sense that, you know, I don't have a $10,000 stereo system, and I don't get all hung up on audio quality. You know, music is about the experience for me. And, and I find vinyl to be difficult. You know, it's expensive to manufacture. It's heavy. It's hard to ship, and it's a petroleum product. So I'm a little bit morally opposed to vinyl.
Yeah, it is heavy to move around. I still have my vinyl collection from years, and it's heavy. We've got about a minute left. Last Wednesday, I made sure that I got to Middlesex to see Dobe, and to enjoy the music, but also because I wanted to make sure someone was there for her. But I needn't have worried, right?
Yes. I know. It was crazy how many people turned up. I mean, she had far more people at that show than she ended up having in Portland, Oregon the next week. So,
incredible.
You know, that's what I love about doing shows in Vermont. And I've done a lot of these, brought artists to these small rural communities and stages. And it's always such a joy to see both how many people respond and how much they respond. Yeah. I mean, there's so much joy and dancing and participation and the artists inevitably have a great time and love it.
She said she didn't want to leave. She wanted to stay here. That was my favorite part of the evening. Jacob Edgar is the founder of Kombucha based in Charlotte, and you can learn more at kombucha.com. Jacob, I want to thank you, and we're going to leave with Wesley. We're going to hear a little music on the way out from another one of your artists, Wesley. Thanks very much, Jacob.
Excellent. Who's playing in Charlotte on August 14th?
Oh, fantastic. All right.
Yep.
All right, let's give a listen to Wesley, who now resides in Montreal. When we come back, we're going to visit Farmcraft Vermont. Just ahead at 11 this morning, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. I'm always on the lookout. So as I was heading to a friend's house in Hinesburg, I saw one of those signs you pass and might never notice. Oh, but I do. Farmcraft Vermont. I wonder what that is. So I looked into it to find out what they do. They make this and this and that, and they offer glamping. And that's how I find guests. Joining me now is Tim Lindemeyer. He is one of the owners of Farmcraft Vermont in Shelburne. Tim, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Listeners to ask Tim about the unique items that they craft at Farmcraft Vermont. You can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tim, what is Farmcraft Vermont?
Well, the short version is it's a seed-to-soap herb farm where we are trying to combine regenerative farming, traditional crafting, with net zero facilities using local resources and offering multi-generational education with our kids being involved and just experiencing the lifestyle. And we're... really trying to see if there's a model out there for a sustainable kind of microeconomy and that is capable of weathering the impacts of climate change and pandemics and global instability. So really taking a look at what we can grow here, what we can do with what we grow here outside of food production.
You do have quite a bit going on there. Can you give us a quick tour of the farm?
Sure. As you come into the property, you'll see, some wildflower gardens and kind of a rundown, dilapidated building that we keep some of our animals in as storage. It was the original building on the property. Mm. And then you'll see a sign towards some camper and overflow parking that will wind you around to the farm shop. parking area. And there's a little cabin that we sell all the products that we make here on the farm. And then to the south of that, there's a large sunflower field that's in full bloom right now. So that's beautiful. Ooh. And then there's a quarter acre herb garden that's terraced down the hillside, southwest facing, in which we grow nearly 50 varieties of herbs that we harvest and distill or dry for our teas and or essential oils and hydrothal. And then you kind of can wind around the property on a variety of driveways and paths to find some of our food production for our personal needs. And then another sunflower field, some ponds and pollinator meadows, and then we also have a few tent sites that we offer through Hip Camp. And then there's our homestead, you know, which is a net zero house with greenhouse attached, patio, and then behind that is our newest building, which is the farm lab and soon to be an Airbnb rental.
One-bedroom
apartment.
What got the business started, Tim?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, if you go back in our history, when we first met, we started a two-acre herb farm out in Taos, New Mexico, both being New Englanders. I from Vermont and Becca from Maine. We met in New Mexico, of course, and we started an organic farm out there. And so it was the feeling of that business was it was very communal-based, and we really appreciated that. And, you know, moving ahead forward, 24 years as of yesterday.
Wow.
We ended up here. Yeah, I mean, we've been in Vermont for the last, I think, since 1999 is when we moved back. And we had an ecological landscape design build business for most of those years. And Becca went and managed the Williston Gardner Supply Store. And it was really the pandemic that kind of pushed her home and was trying to do management from there, and she found a little bit of free time to play around with some other ideas, and FarmCraft is kind of what emerged. You know, we've always been sustainably oriented, mm-hmm. and that focus was mostly on our own personal food, and then we started thinking about, well, what about all the other crafts? What can we grow here that would also be part of how we need to live? And you know, soap and shampoos and lotions and all those sort of things. Becca started doing deep research on that and found that a lot of that could be done from ingredients we can grow.
We're going to talk a lot about what you offer one at a time, but since I'm a big fan of handcrafted soaps, let's start there. How many different soaps do you produce?
Oh, geez, I don't even know if I could get that. You know, we have our eight mains, and then we have some seasonal different soaps, you know, and so each season could be, you know, 1 to 3 to 4 different soaps that Becca will produce.
What makes the soap special, Tim?
Well, I think, you know, a big part of it is there's no additives to it. They're all natural scents. Using as much essential oils as we can produce here. For the soaps that use tallow, you know, that comes from our local supplier up on Bear Trap in Road in Milton from La Platte Beef. They sell us their beef suet. We render it down here at the lab. And so that's the base for some of the soaps. She also makes some vegan soaps. And, or at least vegetable based soaps. So yeah, does that answer your question?
It does. And then you have a couple in some beautiful designs. Tell people about the soap eggs.
The soap eggs. You know, so Easter came around and that's one of those seasonal designs that Becca came up with. And then just recently we've had another local farm stand ask us to mimic their colorings of their eggs so they could start selling them in their farm shop as well, Clean Farm. And so, yeah, you know, we did some research on finding a mold and then we kind of mimicked it after a real egg.
Yeah, and they're beautiful. I had to do a double take the first time I saw them. Because I thought they were actually eggs.
I was just given a tour of the lab, and the ladies that I was giving the tour to, they were like, "Are those real eggs?" I'm like, "No."
You do these make and takes for the soaps and other products. So what happens at those events?
Yeah, so it's really, you know, Becca is spending, you know, usually two to four hours, depending on the class. And she's either demonstrating, you know, a particular product. If it's a soap, then she's making soap. And that can be some hands-on experience, but, you know, it depends on the level of technicality, mm-hmm. you know. And so that would be a situation where they would help make the soap and learn how to make the soap. And at the end of it, you would take home a bar of soap.
How often are those offered?
You know, it varies. We're finding that the summer months are a little slower with make and takes, so we're kind of putting a little bit of a pause on those for the rest of the summer months, and we'll pick those back up in the fall months. They're relatively a new addition to what we're offering, just because during the pandemic we were a little gun shy about, you know, offering classes in a lab space.
Yeah. Point well taken. Now, balms and lotions are next on my list of things you're making there. Tell us about the different products in that lineup.
Oh, man, there's a slew of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, so Becca has, you know, I would say sensitive skin, you know, so that was a big driver on her doing a lot of research on finding alternatives and all naturals to what you can buy at your local CVS or Bed Bath and Beyond or whatever, Body Works. And so she came up with different recipes for different skin types. And so whether it's dry skin or oily skin, she has different variations on the balms and the lotions. And whether it's your face, your hands, your body, so there's quite a line, and I would encourage people to go to the website, farmcraftvermont.com, to learn more about each product. All the ingredients are listed on the website, and then if you have any follow-up questions, shoot us an email, text, phone call, or come visit the farm. We're happy to share what we know and continue to learn how to do things even better.
All right, Tim, how do you develop all these products that you sell at Farmcraft Vermont?
Well, we just recently, initially, it started out in the basement, like any good homespun business.
Sure.
Becca was crafting down in the basement for nearly a year and a half, and then we just finished the lab portion of the new building that we built. And so she's now out there, which is a much healthier space for her just from a mindset ways, because it's a lovely views of our gardens. And it's just a much, much cleaner, not cleaner, but, you know, it's a nice organized space where she has all the tools and equipment and room to spread out. And it also enabled us to have some part-time help, which has been awesome.
Oh, that's great. Now, what makes bugs repel your bug sticks and bug spray?
Well, that would be the natural bug repellents that are in it. And that can be a combination of things, citronella and I'm forgetting the other one right this minute. But, yeah. Again, go to the website. The ingredients are all right there.
We'll consider that other one proprietary information right now, but it is on farmcraftvt.com. Okay. Tell us about, I love these, the flower fizzies, Tim. I'm sure you use these quite often at the end of the day.
Well, the shower steamers is more my favorite thing. they're similar, you know, just not hopping in the bathtub all the time. But, you know, it's an all natural, you know, bath bomb is with a new name and a little bit of, you know, we add flowers on top of it to beautify them as well. And but then also we offer the shower steamer, which has been really popular. It's a small cube. It's infused with essential oils, and as it dissolves, the aroma will steam up off the floor. Or you can put it in a little cup next to the shower if you want it to last a little longer. And so, yeah, those have been two very popular products for us, along with.
Yeah, great aromatherapy involved with both of those. You offer several different types of face masks as well.
We do, yeah. You know, again, not a product that I use very often. Certainly one that's popular amongst a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, you have that natural beauty and glow and don't necessarily need the face mask as much as other people. So we understand that. Now, Tim, all this and glamping too at FarmCraft. So what kind of accommodations do you have?
So, you know, the glamping was kind of a thought of how we could bring people to see the farm a little bit. And so we have three tents that are, you know, pretty cushy. They have foam mattresses in them up off the floor and little campfire setups for cooking and picnic tables. And so, yeah, we've really used the platform Hip Camp, and it's been great for bringing people here that are interested in the farm and some people that are just here to catch a show over at the Shelburne Museum or Higher Ground. And yeah, it's worked out really well. I enjoy having people come and meeting new people. It was a way, given that we don't leave the farm very often, for us to have a sense of community outside and within our existing local community.
Mm. So. How many can stay at a time in those accommodations?
Our largest capacity is six.
Mm-hmm. And then
we also have a pitch your own site that people can pitch their own tents, up to two tents pretty comfortably in the space. So a lot of it comes down, you know, and you can pitch an additional tent in most of the other sites as well. So we're flexible. If you really need a larger group, you know, we could make ways to accommodate.
Now, I know you love pollinators there. Tell us about the fact that you're bee-friendly and the honey that products that you have.
Sure. So we have five hives, and like all beekeepers in Vermont, I think we struggle with, you know, keeping them healthy. You know, it's a tough time for bees in general. But one thing that we do is all the old hay fields that were here, with the exception of where we're growing sunflowers, we've kind of let go and been adding seed to the seed bank that's there, other native seeds, and really encouraging pollinator wildflowers, essentially. So through that management, we're giving the bees plenty of food, but we're also very aware that we want all our pollinators, because they help us grow food and herbs and everything. If I had to go out there and pollinate all the little flowers, it'd be a tough job.
And you guys you're busy enough over there at FarmCraft. Tim, yesterday I had Julia Pupko on from the Center for Eco Studies. She is the lady beetle person, found a couple of those rare lady beetles that have been missing. And you guys play your part. You have these neat bio blitzes there at the farm. Tell people about that.
We do. So it's an opportunity to invite people over to basically catalog what we have on the property. And it's just a way to get a better understanding of what the status of our local ecology on this particular property is. And which is, you know, like anything, the more information we have, the better we can move forward in making good decisions on that, how to help manage it, or maybe step back and not manage it at all.
And you're perfectly placed, because tomorrow I will be speaking about the Open Farm Week that's coming up, and people will be able to come and get a tour there, right?
That's correct. On Sunday, the 7th of October, we have tour from 2 to 4.
Of August. You said yeah. October. You yeah. mean this oh, Sunday. Okay. That's all right.
I was reading the 8th thinking, I don't know what I was thinking.
That's
yeah.
all right.
Of August. And then also on the 13th, this Saturday. And you can sign up on Dig In Vermont is the way to sign up for those open farm week tours.
All right. How about any other upcoming events that you have there at FarmCraft?
Yeah. So we also have Sunflower Sunday coming up on the 21st of August. And that's an open house. There's no charge. And it'll be an opportunity for people to come and have an informal tour in the herb garden. We'll have a distilling demo, probably a donation per stem for picking your own sunflowers, seeing the front field and the back field at that time will be in bloom. So yeah, there's that. And then also on the 3rd of September, the International Workshop on Agritourism is trying to do a group. It's a full day multi-farm tour group package, and you can learn more and register on Origins of Food website for that. And I think that registration needs to be done before 8/12. And I think they're looking for more registration to make sure that they can pull it off. So that I would really like to encourage people to do that because you get to go and see pretty cool farms.
Tim, I got to wonder if you and Becca and the kids get any rest there at FarmCraft.
We do. You know, we've really embraced what we're doing as our lifestyle. You know, so once you shift your mentality to it not being work, but just how you want to live your life, you know, it's just something that we do, and we enjoy doing it, and we try to keep that perspective most of the time, and we sneak in opportunities to get away when we can, and, you know, it's always difficult in the beginning when you're building a business.
Yeah.
And the girls are getting older, so they always have their own things going on. We have one, you know, one in Washington State going to college, and doing some great stuff up there, and another one that still is a senior at CU. So.
Love it. Becca and Tim Lindenmeyer are the owners of FarmCraft Vermont in Shelburne. And to learn more, you can visit farmcraftvt.com. Tim, thank you so much for sharing all the things you're making there and for being on the show this morning.
Thanks so much to you, Rick. I appreciate you and your show.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Feel free to suggest guests or topics by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint and subscribe to the podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we have our next wine show. We get ready for the Vermont Open Farm Week, and we get to know our peregrine falcons.